Bonjour à tous, merci d'être présents à cette table ronde. On a la grande chance d'avoir Norman Swinrad avec vous, avec nous et avec vous. Si vous êtes un peu habitué du festival, eh bien, il est là quasiment tous les ans. Norman, c'est un invité fidèle du festival des Utopiales. Ça valait bien une rencontre parce que la carrière de Norman Swinrad est absolument énorme et c'est aussi quelqu'un qui a un regard, une vision sur la science-fiction et sur le monde contemporain. Donc on va pouvoir discuter de tout ça. Et en plus, cette année, il est au sommaire de l'anthologie des Utopiales avec une nouvelle sur un premier contact, un contact extraterrestre. Donc on en dira un petit mot. Juste avant, pour vous dire que vous avez des casques, si Norman s'exprime en français ou en anglais.
Je ne sais pas. Peut-être que je parle un mélange de français et anglais. Ça marche comme ça?
Oui, ça marche très bien. Okay. Prenez le casque au cas où, comme ça, voilà, ça lui laisse la liberté de switcher en anglais-français comme il veut. Et puis, comme ça, tout le monde pourra nous comprendre. Puis si vous êtes anglais, comme ça, vous pourrez comprendre ce que je raconte. Ma première question un petit peu Normand, c'était simplement, j'aurais le titre de cette conférence, c'est « Bleu comme une orange ». Un roman un peu particulier. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous raconter la genèse de ce roman, Bleu comme une orange?
Ah, première, c'est pas mon titre. En anglais, it's Greenhouse Summer. Et j'étais dans mon appartement en Paris, plein novembre. C'est un petit jardin. Merci. Pour la plupart, toutes les plantes sont mortes, c'est gris, c'est froid. Et je lis une chose, je ne sais pas, dans un magazine ou au journal, le problème avec le réchauffage de la planète. Et je vois dans la fenêtre, c'est mauvais pour quelque part de le monde, mais pas pour Paris, je préfère un Paris tropical. Et alors, ça, c'est l'idée, le commencement de la semi pour le roman. C'est vrai que c'est la partie de la planète qui ont tombé mal pour le réchauffage. Autre part, non, c'est bien, Sibérie, Canada, etc. And that was the beginning of the ardor of what I will call Greenhouse Summer, because that's my title. And that's how it began. There are going to be winners, and there are going to be losers. And the ultimate question, la question ultimate, c'est la question morale et pas scientifique. Because to save, what do you do if to save the plant, to save the biosphere from being destroyed at a niveau global, and in order to prevent this, the parts of the planet who have benefited are going to have to give up something good, and that was the genesis of the novel. C'est mieux comme ça en France, en anglais, I don't know. Je parle français, je parle anglais, je parle mélange. Le mélange,
c'est bien. Les deux, c'est bien.
Vous avez un vote. Mélange, anglais, français. Non.
Right, no. Tout le monde. D'accord.
Ah, OK. Allemand, non.
on le voit bien, il y a une empreinte sur, évidemment, l'actualité, sur l'actualité écologique. Et souvent, vos romans traitent de la société ou de faits de société. On se rappelle de Jacques Baron, des choses comme ça. Est-ce que la science-fiction, pour vous, c'est vraiment un moyen de parler du monde et des thématiques d'actualité?
I'm not sure I understand the question. But what I have always said is technology itself is morally neutral. It's what we do with the technology that is the moral question. And I think to the extent that I'm dealing with technology that doesn't exist or technology that does exist but has an effect on culture or the planet, that's the source of drama, really, because the best drama I think, either on a niveau personnel or a political or cultural level, is not the conflict between good and evil, but the conflict between different concepts of what is good. And I think that informs a lot of my stuff, and a lot of literature in general that's really any good.
Juste, je fais une parenthèse là-dessus. Votre dernier livre s'appelle Le Temps du Rêve, qui est paru il y a un an à peu près. Là, on est plus sur la thématique de la réalité virtuelle. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous dire un petit mot sur ce livre-là?
Well, I think I did this before anybody else twice. I invented the internet before Al Gore, way before Al Gore, the title of the book in English was The World Between. En français, c'est La Grande Guerre de Bleu et de Rose, un autre chose comme ça. L'idée de l'internet lui-même, le web, and I think I called it that, and a démocratie électronique, avec le deux parts de le parlement. Un, c'est les choses conventionnelles, et l'autre, c'est le public lui-même dans le web, dans l'internet. Et ça, c'est une chose comme ça. Mais en avance de ça, j'écris un petit roman, une grande nouvelle, what the hell is it? En anglais, Riding the Torch. En français, Les Avaliers de Vide. And in that, c'est un appareil qui était implanté direct dans le cerveau, qui donnait toutes les personnes dans cette société, même en connexion de toutes les choses de le passé, comme un super Google ou même Wikipédia ou choses comme ça. Et à l'autre côté, la possibilité d'entrer dans le sensorium d'une autre personne. Pour la plupart maintenant, réalité virtuelle, c'est quoi? C'est la vision et le son, et ça c'est tout. Un peu de motion, des choses comme ça. Mais dans les avaliers de vide, avec le truc qui était implanté directement dans le cerveau, vous avez aussi tous les autres sens, de goût, de pression, des choses comme ça. Et vous avez la possibilité de transporter votre conscience dans un corps d'une autre personne. That was 70 ou comme ça, long in advance de Al Gore. C'est un blog, mais pas un blog, totalement un blog. Parce qu'Al Gore, quand il était en université, il fait le fric pour. Il a créé un programme Algorithms, et c'est un drum kit. Algorithms maybe is funny in English. It doesn't make too much sense in French. But he really did that. He did not. He invented the drum machine, maybe, but not the internet.
Vous disiez qu'effectivement, vous aviez raconté Internet presque avant Internet. Est-ce qu'il y a une partie visionnaire dans ce que vous faites sur le futur? Est-ce que vous le pensez comme ça?
Well, I mean, that's what you're doing if you're writing science fiction or anything like it, which I prefer to call speculative fiction, which is a broader definition. Because the essence of speculative fiction or science fiction is it has to be there has to be an element in it that doesn't exist but could exist. So you really have to, it has to be set in the near future, the immediate future, or the far future. It really can't be set in the past, and it really can't be set in the present. So in that sense, in the hardware sense, in the technological sense, I think, you know, you have to be visionary about it, or you can't write this sort of thing. You just can't. But en anglais, visionnaire, c'est quelque chose. C'est visionnaire littéral, c'est on veut le... Vous avez en vision de une chose à la future, une chose concrète, technologie, changement politique, quelque chose comme ça. Mais, but in English, peut-être aussi en français, it also can mean a kind of idea of visionary consciousness, en vision de la conscience humaine qui change, peut-être primarily positive. Ça c'est visionnaire. Si c'est une dévolution, ça c'est pas visionnaire. Ça c'est rétro. Or shows comme ça. So I think the first part about the technology and things like that, I don't think that's at all unique with me, because I don't think you can write speculative fiction or science fiction without doing that. But a lot of science fiction or speculative fiction does somehow not have that visionary consciousness, and doesn't necessarily require that to be real science fiction. A lot of it doesn't. A lot of it doesn't. If you look at the movies, all of them don't. Most of them. We were on an airplane coming from New York. We saw the new Star Trek. Obviously, Star Trek, the new Superman, and some other thing I forget what it was called, but it didn't really matter what it was called. It was all the same thing. Explosions, people punching people, shooting them with guns, stepping on their faces, and wall to wall. They didn't at least have, except for the Superman, I think, any car chases, which was the fault of these two movies, because usually you have to have a car chase. So that stuff is science fiction of a kind. You can't disown it that way, but it really doesn't have a visionary element. It's that kind of science fiction is to the kind of speculative fiction I'm talking about as pornography is to erotic art, something like that. It's a jerk-off.
Vous avez souvent eu des romans qui ont suscité au moins la discussion, si ce n'est parfois la polémique. Hein. Alors moi, j'ai vu pas mal de discussions justement passer sur le temps du rêve, mais on se souvient que Jacques Baron, ça a provoqué pas mal de discussions, mais Le Printemps russe aussi. Quand on est écrivain, susciter autant de débats comme ça, c'est un plaisir, vous voyez, que les gens s'interrogent, discutent de vos romans, parfois que ça les choque ou que ça les interpelle.
Un plaisir.
Pourquoi pas, vous pourriez les faire
pour moi, l'acte d'écrire, pour le plus grand, c'est un plaisir pour moi. C'est quelqu'un écrivain qui dit, oh non, c'est dur, je travaille, c'est très dur, c'est triste, c'est nécessaire être triste. Ça, c'est pas pour moi. If I understand the other part of your question, which is kind of complicated, and It's not possible to say this in English. I have to. Je dis en français. L'idée de politique, le sens engagé, et politique politicienne, and autre chose. In English, it's very hard to make that distinction. Je crois que je suis engagé comme un écrivain, mais aussi un citoyen d'un pays, de planète, et tout ça. Et ça, c'est un métapolitique. Mais pour écrire un roman avec un niveau métapolitique, je crois que c'est nécessaire en descendre et d'un niveau imaginaire d'un pot de politique, politicien, pour, pas pour faire le support pour un parti spécifique, mais pour imaginer un futur concret. It's a difficult question to answer, and maybe I'm not the right person to answer it. Some people might say, "No, you're an out-and-out anarchist, or you're an out-and-out communist, or whatever they might say this stuff is." I have been called in public a communist by fascists, and I've been called a fascist by communists. I think that's good. But I don't think I'm the person exactly to answer this part of that question.
Est-ce que quelque part c'est aussi pour ça que vous faites de la science-fiction, pour ce côté un peu engagé, dire des choses?
I'm not sure I understand that either. But I think that, well, our friend Harlan Ellison, I have to say this in English, can't say this in French, has a little saying on his wall frame: I am an artist, I should be exempt from shit. Well, needless to say, you're not exempt from shit. You would like to be, but you're certainly not. And I think, unless there's really something wrong with you, that, you know, that's my job. I mean, it's my vocation. It's my calling. But I think, just as a human being, like any other human being, I have my responsibilities and necessities and visions just as a citizen. And because of what I do for a living, I really can't quite divorce those two things. Well, I'll give you an example what I mean. C'est un roman en direct, Pictures at 11 en anglais. Un part de ça, c'est les terroristes qui ont capturé le nouvel lui-même en petite station de télé. Et avec de veste, mais sans veste, avec pas le bombe conventionnel, mais une espèce de dirty bomb. Et à cette époque, I didn't hear anybody describe this thing. And I was saying, I was fighting with myself. Should I really write this? In other words, this is a dirty bomb. C'est de bombe atomique. It's a bomb de plutonium or chose comme ça. C'est pas possible de faire une grande explosion, mais une explosion avec semtex or nitroglycerin or chose conventional comme ça qui ont grand that makes a cloud of radioactive material that can poison a whole city. This thing can be made. I know how to make it myself. It's not that hard, if you're willing to kill yourself doing it. And that was an example. Well, should I write this thing? Or should I, and finally, well, I decided I need the money. No, I decided that since it was possible, somebody was going to say it sooner or later. So I did write it. I don't know if I did the right thing or not. But nobody's used this bomb yet. Now everybody's talking about it, and everybody knows, not everybody, enough people know how to do it. I wrote a novelette called The Big Flash. I don't know what that's called in French. Qu'est-ce que c'est ça en français? C'est un groupe de rock and roll qui était, which in love with the atomic bomb, and there's songs in it about brighter than a thousand suns and do it I wrote this thing. I went to the Milford Conference in Pennsylvania with the House of Damon Knight. And he went out in the woods and he picked mushrooms and he wrote Do It like mushroom. And when I came in here, I was kind of horrified because the idea of the novel was that the military uses the music to get people to want to use the bomb. And then at the very same time, and the thing was there too, the Jefferson Airplane had an album called The Crown of Creation, and it had the bomb on it in the same way. And this was a conference of writers and editors, and there was a debate about whether this thing should be published or not. Well, it was published. It was published. It's been published many times. And the bomb hasn't gone off yet. I don't know if this answers the question or just opens it up. But that's really, you have to. Sometimes you have to think about things like this. So far, I can say, I think, well, maybe not, that I, I've never made that. I always, okay, I'll write it. I was going to say it was never a mistake. But le format de Bug Jack Barrett, the mission, ça c'est j'ai inventé un format comme ça. And it was used, taken up, at least in America, by a bunch of really unpleasant right-wing politicians to do that. So I suppose in some ways I'm responsible for Rush Limbaugh, and I don't feel really responsible for Rush Limbaugh, but there were actual Pat Buchanan who ran for president, followed the scenario, and that was kind of disturbing. Except, all right, and I'll get off this topic with this, because it's something that Robert Heinlein said to me. Charles Manson had really been involved with Stranger in a Strange Land and all that. So I asked Heinlein about this. And I said, how do you feel about the Manson family and Stranger in a Strange Land and all that? And he said, the manufacturer takes no responsibility for misuse of a product. And I guess that's the answer to this question. I said, but Heinlein answered it for me, finally, I think, maybe.
Je rebondis sur Jacques Baron et l'éternité. Est-ce que vous avez l'impression qu'on vit un petit peu dans le monde de Jacques Baron maintenant?
The smartphone didn't exist. The video phone didn't exist. All that exists now. The kind of reality television like that I more or less invented. The politics for a while were different, but now they become more alike, because in the book, the Republican Party becomes a smaller, crazy, right-wing, plutocratic, fascist party, and that's what's happening. There's very little in there, in Jack Baron, really, that's obsolete, except a little bit of the technology. Wait a minute, I invented the video. I didn't invent it. Other people had it. But it wasn't a smartphone, you know, and you couldn't play Angry Birds on it or anything like that. But I think we've really come around to that. And then I met a guy, I can't remember his name, who was really trying to do the Freezer project, to freeze people so they could live forever. Remember what that was called, Donna? They really do it. I saw a documentary about this, supposedly, where they have Timothy Leary's head in liquid nitrogen, as well as a famous baseball player, Ted Williams. And it's the same thing. You pay money if you have money, and you'll go into cryogenic freezing, and maybe sometime in the future they, you know, revive you. But Phil Dick wrote some really funny stories about this. Yeah, they revive your consciousness, but you turn out to be the operating system of an elevator or a refrigerator or something. So I don't think there's anything in there that's obsolete. The only thing in there that's obsolete was obsolete in the book, and it's becoming obsolete now, is the American Republican Party. I think it's truer now than it ever was. The ending remains to be seen, but the situation, there it is.
Une petite question sur votre inspiration. C'est vrai que vos livres sont souvent différents, entre Bleu comme une orange ou Printemps russe ou Jacques Baron, c'est très différent. Comment naissent un petit peu vos idées de roman?
No, I don't think I understand that in any language.
Comment vous imaginez un petit peu vos romans et comment vous vous dites, tiens, tel sujet, j'ai envie d'en faire un livre?
Oh, how do I do it? It's a good question. I think the way I do it is I have a story I want to tell, and I have to invent a context for it in the future or something like that. And then I have to do research to see what makes sense from books. More recently, you know, from all the things on the internet that you can find, pictures, films, it's the same. You know, I've written two historical novels as well. The Druid King, which has not been published here because the movie was so terrible, and Mexico, which is the story of the conquest, the true story of the conquest of Mexico by Cortez. And, you know, having done that, I realized that it's sort of the same thing. In one case, you have to do research to reconstruct a society of pests that really existed at the time, but you can't go there and walk around. On the other hand, when you're creating, say, something like Le Printemps Russe, you have to do something of that, but then you have to imagine, the word is in English is extrapolate from what the present thing is, and then you invent, and you try and be convincing. So for me, it's almost always the story that comes first. The story is the dramatic aspect, characters, what I want to write about, and then I have to do the research to create the world in which it happens. I think every writer, every novelist, either does it, even for contemporary fiction too. If I wanted to write, somebody wants to write a polar that takes place in Nantes and Utopias, they have to have been here or have read about it or seen it on television to know where the stairs go and where the food is and what's outside and so forth. This is getting a little bit away from things, but I think there is a certain kind of so-called mainstream fiction, which fails to do this, and is therefore much weaker because of it. It's too internalized inside the character, and the world that the characters live in is, you know, generic, and it's our world sort of, and doesn't, and that kind of fiction even doesn't take into account the fact that any characters, their very consciousness, their very existence is going to be partially determined by the world they live in very specific and powerful ways. And I think one of the reasons I write a lot, mostly science fiction, is that I think it's a complete fiction, whereas that other kind of stuff really isn't. I mean, I've written some contemporary. Le Miroir de l'Esprit, that's a contemporary novel, but you have to do the same thing. And have I written any other contemporary? Something that hasn't been published at all yet has been is called Police State. It's set completely in New Orleans and a little bit in the rest of Louisiana. And we spent like 3 weeks there doing research for it after doing all the things you could do on the internet or reading books and stuff like that. That's the answer.
Je voudrais faire une petite parenthèse sur La Nouvelle dans l'anthologie des Utopiales. Qui raconte un peu un premier contact extraterrestre. Est-ce que vous vous en souvenez? Vous pouvez nous dire un petit peu comment vous l'avez construite, imaginée?
Why did I write? How did that write? I don't remember. It was an Italian newspaper. I forget which one. Do you remember which one? La Pubblica Sera, one of the big Italian newspapers, wanted a short story from me. I forget exactly. Or maybe it was they wanted a first contact story or something like that. Yeah. And so that's how that started. The other thing that came from was when they were doing the first Explorer probe that was going to leave the solar system and go out, you know, into interstellar space for millions and millions of years or whatever, they put pictures of humans, they put some music and stuff on it, and they put a thing in several languages that said something like, this is a probe from people of the planet Earth to learn, if we are fortunate, to teach if we are called upon to teach. And so that, I think, was the moral or whatever core of writing that story. It wasn't so much as first contact, it was that. I mean, it was a kind of first contact, but not what anybody expected. And we might have that kind of first contact in reality, but that's a whole other story. This is the golden age of astronomy, and what we know about the universe today has expanded to a point where it's so complicated that we're at the beginning of prehistory here, and that's all.
Vous avez, on parle beaucoup de science-fiction. Je voudrais savoir un peu quel est votre regard global sur la science-fiction aujourd'hui. Comment est-ce que vous trouvez la SF d'aujourd'hui, que ce soit la vôtre ou celle d'autres auteurs.
Global.
Oui.
Je lis quelque chose en français. I read stuff in English. I read anything else I read, I'm reading from translation. One thing I can say, c'est la science-fiction français est vachement plus grand, vachement plus profond dans le dernier, je ne sais pas, dessiné ou choses comme ça, when I first came to France. And I think there's as much probably if not more, really good science fiction being written in French than in English and being published. I remember when I was first here, it was very hard for French writers to publish their science fiction at all. Now all that has changed. All that has changed. Much for the better. So I think science fiction has become more global. Has become more global. I mean, I've done something that because I have carte blanche with Asimov's magazine. The deal was, if I'm going to write this column, nobody tells me what I can or I can't do. And I think three or four times I've reviewed books that were only in French, even though it was in American magazine. I just wanted to do it. I thought it was important. The last one, of course, which was Rêve de Gloire, Roland Wagner, a great novel. And whether it ever gets into English, I don't know. But it was a groundbreaking novel in a transnational sense, and I thought I should review it, whether it was in English or not, as long as I could read French. For all I know, there were things like that are only in Russian or in Chinese or, I'm sure, in Japanese, which doesn't get translated very much out of Japanese, it's become an international literature. And the domination of Anglophone science fiction that existed, you know, for 50 or 60 years doesn't exist anymore. And it's curious, you think about it, that the big cleavage way back when, in the beginning of science fiction, between the kind of technophilic science fiction and another more political kind of science fiction was between H.G. Wells in English and Jules Verne in French. So I think I feel more positive about the globalization of science fiction than I do about the globalization of the economy, which is a disaster. And I feel more positive about world science fiction. In terms of all these different countries, than I do about what's going on in the States, which is not good at all. It's very retro and very commercial, and I think that, you know, there are still good writers. There are still some good books that are published. It's not, you know, it's like in a year, if there are 20 really good novels published, it's a good year. Even if there are 1,000 pieces of crap. The haystack gets bigger, but there are not fewer needles in it. But that makes it harder to find the needles.
Je l'ai dit tout à l'heure en préambule, vous venez souvent à Nantes. Quelle relation vous avez particulièrement avec la France? Pourquoi vous aimez venir chez nous?
I originally came to France. Well, I was a guest of honor at Metz, which was the first time I'd been here. I met Richard Pinhas, met Richard in California, and I got involved in actually being a singer on a record, gradually was visiting France, and I always wanted to try living here. And then finally I got the idea for Russian Spring, which is mostly set in Paris, and decided to write the book of, you know, go live in France for 9 months, for a year, to write the book, which did. But then, I don't know, two things happened. One was, it became so much more interesting in Europe than it was in the States. As I always say, Europe is not just, for an American, Europe is not just another planet, it's another solar system. You have the big planets, you have England, France, Italy, and so forth. You have little, smaller ones, maybe like moons, like Belgium and Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, and so forth. Then you have some asteroids like San Marino and Andorra and stuff like that. And the wall was coming down. I walked through the wall while it was coming down. Literally, they were bashing it down with hammers, and they were trying to sell you hammers to hit the wall, but I had my own hammer. Actually, it was junk on the ground, so I just picked it up and walked through the Berlin Wall. And also, I preferred living in France. France particularly because by that time, I had a lot of friends here. I was culturally connected. France is in the center of Europe. If you speak French, if you're Francophone, you know, you can get along in a lot of countries. But I wrote a thing. I wrote a thing for Le Monde called L'Exception Française. They asked me to write this. And what that was about was, you know, what the French, among other things, but this is like a haiku version. They were arguing with the Americans about the GATT, you know, the trade treaty. And the Americans were saying that the French subsidy of its film industry violated free trade rules. And the French reaction to that was, get stuffed. This is a patrimony. This is an art. And that transcends economy. And that is not the United States at all. And that's the kind of thing that made me feel more culturally connected here than in America. Another thing, I think I put it in L'Exception Française. If an American writer walks into a if a writer walks into a bank in France or in Italy, they're an artist. The same writer walks into a bank in the States, they're an unemployed bum, a clochard of a certain sort. So it's things like that. And it's strange, but I've always felt or came to feel, I mean, I'm not a French citizen or anything like that, but I came to feel that I had more responsibilities of cultural citizenship here in France than I did in the States. I mean, I did things for the French Ministry of, I guess it was culture and education, in New Caledonia. I did things for the French Embassy in Mexico. These are nice trips, you know. But I feel that I've always felt that, you know, I guess I get to go to Nantes, get to go to Saint-Malo, you know, all the good stuff. But I felt that I therefore owed a responsibility if I was asked to do something in a school in a bad neighborhood somewhere, stuff like that. That I had a responsibility to do that too. So it's that kind of connectedness. And then, you know, being here long enough, you develop friendships that last, that are lifelong friendships. We were just in Lyon, and we had been there 10 years ago. Donna was talking to a girl that was 7 years old, and now she's a teenager, and they've got pictures of the 10 years ago what we did there. I've been coming myself to Utopias before it was, I think I'm not supposed to say this, but it's true, before it was in Nantes, when it was in Poitiers. Donor and I and my ex-wife Lee and myself, one way or another, I think I missed one or two of these things. One, I was very sick, and I forget what the other reason was. I had to be someplace else or something like that. So I have very good friends here. I have friends spread out all over France. I started to realize that. You know, I never lived outside of Paris, but I always traveled outside of Paris more than most Parisians. You know, quand j'étais en Paris, je voudrais faire en voyage dans le sud de France.
La Parisienne m'a dit, oh, le papa, en vrai français, ça, non, on ne comprend pas rien de tout, là. I come to the south, and they say, oh, les Parisiens, ça, c'est pas le vrai français, c'est un argot de la Parisienne, des choses comme ça.
That there really is a France profonde in a certain sense. That it's up. As I was saying to somebody last night, talking about the politics, Hollande and all that, and Obama and whoever, that's, you know, that are things better in France than they are in the States? Are things better in the States than they are in France? Well, the economic stuff and, specific political stuff, it comes and it goes. You have what? You have Giscard. You have then you have Mitterrand. You have Chirac. You have Sarkozy. You have Hollande. You have Harry Truman. You have you have Ronald Reagan. You have Jimmy Carter. You have the two Bushes. You have Obama. You have Clinton. That's, I'm not saying it's not important, but that's superficial in terms of what a country really is, what the culture is. And because this is a much older culture, it's much stronger and more pervasive here than it is in the States. There's a Ray Bradbury story I always quote when I'm asked something like this. It's a very short story. The Russians have bombed America, and the American tourists in Mexico are running up the road, frantically, and they still got two Mexicans at a petrol station. And one Mexican asks the tourist as he's filling up, "What's going on?" And he says, "Haven't you heard? Oh, they bombed the United States. It's the end of the world." And off the road he goes. One Mexican looks at the other and says, "What do they mean, the world?" So I guess that's the answer to that. Over time, I feel very culturally, connected here. It's not just the food and the cheap wine, because wine is so expensive in the States. It's horrible. You can't believe how bad it is. I know something that you could buy for 4 euros here is going to cost you 14 euros there, and it's not going to travel well. It's going to be what we call in English plonk, something you might get in a bad tobacco.
Alors, vous l'avez compris, les conférences avec Norman Spinrad, elles pourraient durer 3 heures, parce que c'est toujours très intéressant, on a plein de questions. Simplement, on a le temps pour une petite question dans le public, si quelqu'un a une question pour Norman Spinrad. Non ? Alors moi, je vais poser la dernière question. Okay. Sur quoi est-ce que vous travaillez actuellement? Quel sera le thème de votre prochain roman?
Oh, well, the last novel I finished, I've written some novella and a few things like that, and put, was a thing called Police State, which will be published, I don't know. Well, they just had an upheaval at Fayard. I don't know when what is being published, but sometime in the spring, called Police State, which is not what you think. Not what the title leads you to think it is. It's all set in Louisiana, mostly in New Orleans, and it's about how the police lead an anarchistic rebellion against... Well, what happens is there's one cop who's been, from the bayou, from the Ninth Ward, poor places. He's become a policeman. He's got a family. Everything's cool. He's got a house. But the police are being used to evict people from their houses who can't pay their prêt, but who have guns, like everybody else has guns in America. So they give him a piece of paper to say, go to this house and evict these people. He looks at it. It's his house. And it sort of goes from there. How the police...
become a revolutionary force. Only in Louisiana, maybe. I've spent times in Louisiana before this. It's a very strange place. It is so totally corrupt, and yet it's a kind of corruption that sort of works. Well, they did. This is sort of the spirit of this book, really. There was one of the usual legislature scandals that they always have in Louisiana. And then the television crew is going out and they're doing man on the street reviews. What do you think about the state legislature? And one guy with that Louisiana look says, I don't see why everybody is complaining about our state legislature. We've got the best state legislature money can buy. And that's Louisiana. And that's the book, sort of. It's got voodoo in it and a lot of other things, but I never thought I would end up writing a southern regional novel. But in a way, among other things, police state is that. This is my Louisiana book. I doubt if I'll write another one. And I doubt if I'll write another regional like that, but originally I was going to set this thing in California because I read about something like, and then somewhere I said, no, this is not California, this is definitely Louisiana.
Eh bien voilà, on arrive à la fin de cette table ronde. On m'a demandé de bien respecter le timing. Merci à Norman Spinran, merci à vous. Restez là, il y a une conférence sur la pollution tout de suite. Merci à tous.